Hello, the story of Tristan and Isolde was one of the most popular of the Middle Ages. From its roots in Celtic myths, it passed into written form in Britain a century after the Norman conquest and almost immediately spread throughout Northern Europe. It tells of a Cornish knight and an Irish queen, Tristan and Isolde, who accidentally drink a love potion at the same time, on the same boat, travelling to Cornwall where she is to marry someone else. They have no choice, they consummate their love at sea and from that point must navigate the physical and moral dangers that follow. In one version, he'd slain a dragon, she had saved him from certain death. They were a perfect match. Their love was heroic. But could that excuse their adultery in the minds of medieval listeners, particularly when the church was so clear they were wrong? With me to discuss Tristan and Isolde are Laura Ash, Associate Professor of English at Worcester College, University of Oxford, Juliet Wood, Associate Lecturer in the School of Welsh at Cardiff University, and Mark Kinker, Reader in Medieval German Literature at the University of Cambridge. Juliet Wood, we've said the roots of the story are Celtic. Would you tell us where you think the origins of it are?
Well, the origins are really in the international story patterns that you find in Celtic tales. And one of them is Irish, the story of Deirdre, Deirdre of the Sorrows, who is forced to marry a king, an older king, and falls in love with someone else. And she puts her lover under geish. She approaches him. And they escape periodically from the king. And in the end, he's killed. And she is forced to live with two kings. And she escapes this by throwing herself and killing herself. The other story is Dermod and Grania. Grania also is married to Finn McCool, approaches Dermod again with geish. And they too escape constantly until they are both killed. And you find all over Scotland and Ireland cromlechs, which are the bed of Dermod and Grania. The third one, the really important one, is the location in Cornwall. And that starts with the stone, which sort of says Tristan, son of Cunamaris, is buried here. And that's the basis of assuming that Tristan might have been a historical character, although there's really no proof of that. But certainly the story becomes localised in Cornwall, becomes localised at Castle Dore, that's where Mark's castle is, becomes localised at Isolde's Ford, the ford where supposedly she sort of outsmarts the king. And then that's the point at which the story is taken up by the Anglo-Norman storytellers, people like Beruul in particular. But I think one has to remember how much folklore there is in these tales. Lots and lots of these stories sort of have folk links, more so than I think most other romances in the Middle Ages.
Why are Cornwall and Ireland so, and Wales to a certain extent, so attractive?
Well, they are the edge of Europe. They've always been the sort of perfect place to have these magical stories.
Because they were pushed aside.
Because they were pushed aside. And also I think one has to remember the importance of what is known as the Matter of Britain, which is the whole of the Arthurian tradition, which was a source that people could draw on for courtly
references. What do you mean by the Matter of Britain? Are you talking about
a
book?
All of the stories. It was a collection of material. The poets talked about the Matter of Britain, the Matter of Wales, the Matter of France. And the Matter of Britain included all of the Arthurian material, everything associated with it. It comes out as a term in the 14th century, but it's referred to quite frequently as a distinct body of law which people could draw on, and they did. And I mean, this is basically where all of the romances come from. And most of the Matter of Britain is centred on Britain, basically.
I'm a bit confused. It comes out in the 14th century, but we're talking about a story that's set in the 12th century. So how did it influence those stories in the 10th century?
Because it existed before this. It's only really in the 14th century that people said the Matter of Britain, the Matter of Wales, the Matter of Britain, the Matter of France, the Matter of Troy. But the stories go back much earlier. We have evidence of 8th and 9th century, not much before that. And I always have to add the caveat that although we have evidence in the 8th and the 9th century, the texts are actually 13th century and later.
Right. So are we relying much on oral history there then?
This is what's assumed to be behind it. It is. But of course, oral history is a very, very tricky thing to pin down.
Is there any good archaeological history?
There is archaeological history. Tintagel, Castle Dore, places like that have been excavated. The problem with the archaeological history is that they have in turn created a lot of folklore, particularly in the 1930s when the first big excavations were done. People were actually looking for proof of Arthur and Tristan Tristan and Isolde and these stories. And, of course, when you look for proof, you find it. So the archaeology has created a whole strain of new folklore that wasn't there before.
So when you refer to Mark's castle, and Mark was the king who sent for Isolde to marry him, and he was the uncle, we take it, of Tristan in one of the versions... Was there a Mark's castle, or did they, in the 19th century, make it up?
Actually, the 17th century made it up. The references to Castle Dor and Tintagel as Mark's castle are a little bit are later than the text. So we're never really sure how these things were localised or how these things were relocalised.
So we would not be stretching a point to say we're often talking about fiction here.
We are talking completely about fiction. There's really no evidence for Tristan as a historical character.
Well, that means we can go mad, doesn't it, really?
We did. We have.
Laura Ash, one of the first to write down the story, it appears, was Thomas of Britain. What do we know about him?
Very little. We know that he was called Thomas because he tells us himself twice in the bit of poetry we've got, and because the German poet who translated his work into German a few decades later calls him Thomas of Britain. We know he was working around 1170, in the 1170s, say, 1160s to 80s. We know he was probably from Normandy, but he was working in England. And he was certainly writing for aristocratic courts and audiences. And that's about all we know.
He wrote in French?
He wrote in French, which was, of course, at the time, the language of England's aristocracy.
And what sort of text do we have? What's he left behind?
So we think that the whole poem must have been something between 12 and 15,000 lines long. We only have about 3,500 lines. It survives in manuscript fragments.
But didn't later tellers of the story use parts of the text that we now no longer have?
Absolutely. So we can construct, we have constructed what we think Thomas wrote from people who translated him later. So Gottfried translated the whole, well... He began and he had reached almost to the end of Thomas's text, and then he, it seems, died and broke off before he could finish. But we have a whole translation as well, which is in Old Norse. But it's worth bearing in mind that, as Juliet's been implying, there's no such thing really as a whole story of Tristan. I mean, Thomas himself, when he's writing, it's one of the earliest extant texts we have. But he still says, this story comes in many versions, many people have told this story, I've heard many different ways of telling it in many different plots, and here's my version. And he says, my version is definitive, but clearly he thinks of himself as one voice among many.
So is it possible briefly to encapsulate his story of this legend?
Okay. Very briefly, and of course, so most of this is reconstruction from later texts. The story begins with the love affair of Tristan's parents.
What period does he set it in?
The distant past.
Right, that'll do.
Shady distant past.
So from the 12th century perspective, he's saying the distant past.
Exactly, exactly. So it begins with the love affair of Tristan's parents, which is illicit, and they elope, and then it ends tragically because he is killed in battle and she dies of grief in childbirth. Tristan is therefore named Tristan for sorrow. He's brought up... Exactly so. Brought up not knowing who he is, but he ends up at his uncle's court and is accepted as a favourite, makes his way, and then is identified as the nephew of King Mark, and becomes a huge favourite at court. He goes on various exploits and ventures. He defeats an Irish prince challenger, Morold, who comes to demand tribute from Cornwall. And has some various adventures in Ireland. And in the defeat of Morold, he leaves a chip of his sword in Morold's skull. And this is important later, because when he's in Ireland later, trying to win the hand of the Princess Isert for King Mark, Isert matches the piece of sword to the chip in Tristan's sword, realises who he is and wants to kill him, but resists, doesn't kill him. And then he succeeds in winning the right to take her back to Cornwall.
Because he argues it was a fair contest.
Yes. We know that they drink the love potion by mistake at sea, and we have a fragmentary bit of manuscript of that in which Thomas explores what this means and how it happens to them.
Tristan has gone to Ireland at the request of the king.
Correct.
To bring back Isolde, who the king has heard is the right woman for him to marry. So he's there as an ambassador and emissary.
Exactly,
yes.
So, but the reason that Mark has decided that Isert is the bride for him is because Tristan had met her before, spent time with her, came back to Mark and said, "This woman is astonishing." And right. So there's already a tie between Tristan and Isert, which is not openly acknowledged.
So they come back on the boat.
They come back. By this point, Isert is no longer a virgin, and so she persuades her lady-in-waiting, Brengain, to take her place in the marital bed on the first night.
She's taken the love potion accidentally on the ship with him, and they consummate.
And they fall in love, yes. And they have a great time on the boat, which we are told in some detail. And then, so the lady-in-waiting loses her virginity in Mark's marital bed, the substitution is made, and from then on we have the meat of the story, which really is in three sections. There are the long periods when they're at court, conducting their affair clandestinely, and Mark is riven with suspicion. People attempt to expose them, and there's never quite proof, and they're repeatedly challenged and then reinstated. Then there's a phase when Mark can't bear it anymore, and he banishes both of them, and they go into the forest, and the final endgame, and Thomas's version kicks in here. Isert is back at court. Now Tristan is banished alone, and he meets another woman, a beautiful woman called Isert, and he decides for a series of psychologically mad reasons that he will marry this other Isert. And now we have a love quadrangle. And
we can come back to that.
Yes,
it's a very interesting quadrangle. But
finally, he's wounded by poison. Only Queen Isert can save him. She is on her way to save him. His wife tells him that she is not coming, and he dies of despair. And then Isert comes and finds his body, and she lies down and dies also.
In what became the love death much later on in Wagner. Thank
you
very much. Mark Inker, how quickly did the Thomas version spread and to where?
Certainly by the early 13th century, it spread from England to continental Europe and also to Scandinavia. We've got Gottfried's reworking of Thomas's text.
Gottfried of Strasbourg,
yeah. Or that's how he's referred to. I mean, the evidence to connect him with Strasbourg is pretty tenuous. But at any rate, if that's right, that's a version of Thomas reworked into Middle High German, the literary form of German at the early 13th century, probably dated around about 1210, so it's got to Germany. There is, in fact, a second translation of Thomas into German, or made further north, probably somewhere in the northwest, in a literary language which is usually called Low Franconian, so it's the forerunner of literary Dutch. And we just have fragments of this Low Franconian Tristan, again, translated or adapted from Thomas. It's also reached Scandinavia. We also have the Old Norse saga of Tristan and Isolde. That saga is very important because it enables us to reconstruct the whole of the plot of Thomas, because it is, in fact, the only, I think, translation of Thomas surviving that actually completes the whole story. It survives mainly in manuscripts of the 17th and 18th centuries, but those manuscripts contain a prologue in which they say that the translation was made by a monk called Brother Robert in 1226 at the court of King Håkon Håkonarsson, Håkon the Fourth of Norway. You can cast some doubt on the authenticity of that statement because it's only contained in much later manuscripts. But if it's true, and I mean it might be, it would certainly fit with what we know about the court of King Håkon, that Håkon was interested in promoting European literature, love literature, so this would certainly fit with a kind of cultural programme in Norway in the early 13th century.
There's another version by Beruul. Yeah. Who was he and what was his version?
Well, again, Beruul we know nothing about, apart from the name that's transmitted in the text, which, again, is fragmentary.
How long can we go? Nothing about nothing.
it's a Tristan romance in French, yeah. This time in continental French, so not from England, very certainly written in continental France. Our best guess is that it's from the second half of the 12th century.
Well, how was he different from Thomas?
It's different both in the actual plot, it contains different details, and it's very different in the approach that it takes to telling the story. I mean, so far as the plot is concerned, you get quite significant differences in the sequence of events, but I think the most striking difference is that the love potion in Beruul is time-limited. In the Thomas tradition of the story, the potion causes those who drink it to love until they die, so it's absolute and unending love. In Beruul's version, we're told that the potion's effect wears off after 3 years. It works only for that period of time. And
is it different in tone and incident as well?
It's extraordinarily different. I mean, I think one way of characterising the difference, I suppose, is to say that in the Thomas tradition of the story, the storytellers, the authors, are very interested in mining the story for general problems that they can put up for intellectual debate and discussion.
Yeah, can we move to the Beru tradition now?
In Beru, I think the interest is very much in extracting the maximum of narrative suspense and excitement from the story, that you want to make it vivid, dramatic, suspenseful for the audience. For example, there's the episode in which there's a very, very famous episode in which Mark has sentenced the lovers to death. Tristan is to be put to death. Isolt, as she's called, is to be handed over to a colony of lepers. That's her punishment for adultery. So Isolt is being led away by the lepers. Tristan is awaiting execution. He's being held captive in a chapel right on a high rock, you know, when nobody thinks he can escape from. He gets out of the window. He makes this perilous leap hundreds of feet onto the cliffs below, you know, so it's a death-defying leap. And then just in the nick of time, he gets, you know, he gets to ambush the lepers and rescue Isolt and ride off with her into exile in the forest. But it's all narrated for this narrative suspense. You know, will he do it, won't he?
That's very, very clear. So, Juliet, how clear was in the folklore and the subsequent stories the moral? How clear is the moral position of Tristan and Isolt?
Well, folk tales tend not to take a moral position. The moral position will have been inserted by whoever is telling the tale. But it's certainly the case that if you look at the early versions, particularly the Irish and the Scottish versions, it's all about conflict between the duty owed to an overlord. You can see this with Dermot and Finn, and the love of a woman, again, Dermot and Grania. And this carries over, particularly in Beruel, I think, who is often said to have got some of his stories directly from Cornwall, that you have this conflict of kind of duty and love. So it seems to be, very often this is called the primitive version, although I personally don't particularly like that term. But I think it is closer, perhaps, to the kind of complexities you get in the heroic world, where, and certainly in Welsh, you have this image of Mark and of Tristan as heroic characters. Now, there's something very interesting in Beryl, in that he includes this rather strange story that King Mark has horse's ears. Now, Mark in Cornish, Breton and Welsh means horse. So it's not surprising that you get that story, and you find that story quite well attested, particularly in Welsh. So it suggests that Beryl has got closer to the localization of the story in Cornwall, which is back to this notion of the matter of Britain as a major source for the romance writers, the Anglo-Norman and continental romance writers.
Did you give him ears for merely comic purposes, or was this supposed to be significant?
Well,
he grew his hair long, I'm told.
It is probably for comic purposes. I think understanding medieval humour is something which we have problems with. And also, there's something slightly comic about Tristan as well. I mean, again, you get this very tricksterish element to Tristan, which you don't with a lot of the other heroes. The Great Leap, for example. Dermot, his Irish parallel, does these great leaps as well.
And
there are
Mark
lots of coming out of the chapel.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of instances where Tristan will win by outthinking his opponents.
Laura Ash, what's the position of the church on marriage and adultery here? The church is hardening its view of marriage, and yet we are told, we're guided to approve of and root for the two lovers.
Yeah. So during the 12th century, when Thomas is writing, the church had dramatically attempted to have a greater role in marriage. It had said that marriage was no longer just going to be seen as an alliance between noble families. Marriage was a sacrament and it had to rely on the absolute consent of both parties.
So, this was a huge step forward, wasn't it?
Yes, and it's possible to argue, many people have, that the growth in the romance, the sort of fiction of love, is a response to that, saying if marriage has to be about consent, then we now need to understand what consent to that kind of bond would mean. Now, there, of course, we come right up against the problem with Tristan, which is that it's all about love, and love here is, as you say, adulterous, is directly against the bonds of marriage. And so on the face of it, Thomas's narrative runs directly counter to Orthodox Christian teaching, and some critics have argued that he must intend to condemn the lovers. He must just simply be showing their sufferings as a just punishment for their sins. The alternative, the diametrically opposed view, is that no, he's rejecting the church entirely. He's almost elevating love itself as an alternative religion, a cult. And I think that that argument becomes much stronger when you get to Gottfried. But in Thomas's case, I think Thomas's narrative gives us a sense that he's just narrating something that's real, something that happens to people. The church, in the fragments we have, the church barely appears. We don't have any religious figures telling them off or telling them they're doing the wrong thing. And so there's this sense, I think, just of moral independence. But much more interestingly, Thomas develops a moral sense based on not the question of are they sinning or not, but based on the question of the effect they have on others. So he shows us very painfully the hurt they cause to others all around them. And that, I think, develops a much more interesting kind of moral ambiguity than the simple question of are they sinning by loving adulterously.
Mark, I was going to come to you anyway. I know you want to come in. Can I just ask the question I was going to ask? And you can wrap it in what you're going to say. Can we go back to Gottfried of Strasbourg, writing in German, the great stylist, as you all three have described him in your notes? Does he take on this idea of moral ambiguity in any of the ways that Juliet and Laura brought it forward?
Yes, I think he does. Thomas, and then following him, Gottfried, do a very interesting thing in the language that they use to describe the adulterous relation, or in fact, the words that they put into the lovers' mouths themselves, the words that the lovers themselves use to describe their relationship, is very often borrowed from the church's own definitions of marriage. And you can find these formulations, which look like, you know, almost direct translations of the Latin formulations you get in canon law, the law of the church, which provides all kinds of definitions of what the marriage is, what the sacrament is, and what adultery is. For example, when Tristan is agonising over whether he should or shouldn't marry this second Isolde, of course, he frames the problem to himself in terms of what he calls breaking his faith. Mentir ma foi is the phrase. I would break my faith, my oath, my loyalty, my fidelity towards the first Isolde. And what's interesting is that in canon law, the phrase used for adultery is fidem frangere, to break the bond of marital fidelity. So that's very interesting that Thomas allows Tristan to formulate the project of entering into a legitimate marriage and entering an adulterous liaison as though it would itself be an act of faithlessness, of adultery. The canon lawyers insist that marriage is constituted by the two partners consenting to marriage. And canon law often says that it's the wedding ring that symbolises this consent and the bond of the two hearts. And they often refer to the ring as the annulus fidei. It's the ring that symbolises marital fidelity. The interesting thing is in Gottfried, when the lovers are parting, Tristan goes into exile for the very last time. Isolde presents him with a ring and she says, take this ring so that you will remember me by it. But she then describes, she says, it is an insigel der Treue, so a seal or symbol of fidelity. So again, that exact formulation is borrowed from canon law. So it's very striking that both of these authors, Thomas and Gottfried, allow the adulterers to talk about their own relationship as though they were legitimately married in the eyes of the church. And that, I mean, that obviously magnifies the moral ambiguity and ambivalence of the story.
Juliet, are there shifts in the different ways this story is told? Are there significant shifts?
There are. In fact, there are quite strikingly different ways the story is told. The Welsh version, for example, is completely different. And it comes from earliest as the 16th century, but probably before that. And basically in this story, you get Tristan and Isolde, living in the forest, and nobody can attack Tristan, because if you do, his blood will cause your death. You can't wound him. So Arthur has to be brought in. And this is rather interesting, because by this time it seems that in the Welsh tradition, Mark, Tristan and Arthur were always associated. So Arthur is brought in and he says, well, look, one of you is going to live with her when there are leaves on the tree and one of you is going to live with her when there aren't leaves on the tree. And Mark gets to choose. And Mark says, well, I want winter because the nights are longer. And it's Isolde who says, there are three trees that never lose their leaves. Therefore, I'm going to stay with Tristan. And off she goes. It has a happy ending. And it doesn't have
so
any...
She picks the evergreens.
She picks the evergreens. And it's interesting that it's Isolde who does this. She's a very active heroine, and she is right from the start. Deirdre, Dermot, Grant Diarmaid's Grania, are all sort of various kind of, you know, I want you and you're going to have to take me. And this is quite different from many of the other medieval heroines. So there is a kind of sort of way of kind of looking at this tale. It's such an expansive, such an adaptable tale.
And because of that, there's license to add more bits in.
Oh, right, absolutely, absolutely.
Laura Ash, can you began to move to Thomas's handling of the psychological complexity of the four characters. Now, just to get it clear, there's Isolde, and then he goes away and he thinks that he's lost her because she's married to Mark, his uncle.
Yeah.
And he meets another woman called Isolde of the White Hands. And for complicated reasons, you say, he marries her. And can you just tell us what happens in this quadrille?
Yes, so this is where Thomas's story begins as it exists, right in the middle of this debate he's having with himself, should I marry this other Isolde? And he goes through a series of entirely internally contradictory reasons to do it or not to do it. He thinks, she's forgotten me, I know she's forgotten me, I know she hasn't forgotten me, but she's married, so she has pleasure with her husband. Maybe if I were married, I would know what she felt. But then he also tries out the excuse that at least this way she can't blame me for exercising lust with someone else because I were married to them. And then he realises that he only wants this woman because she means Queen Isolde to him. And this comes to fruition horribly when on the wedding night he is getting undressed for bed and the ring that Isolde gave to him that Mark mentioned is pulled off his hand by the shirt that he pulls over his head and off his hand. And he is stricken with the realisation that he has done something terrible and now he has to betray both women because he's married another woman and betrayed Isolde, but also he cannot bear to sleep with this woman and so he betrays his wife by refusing to consummate the marriage.
Which he never does. Isolde of the White
Hand. And Thomas gives us the most astonishing, then, after this psychological exploration of how he could have done this, he then talks to us about what these four suffered in this terrible pattern. So Mark has the body of the woman he loves but will never have her heart, and he knows it. Isolde must submit to her husband in bed but does not want him and does not love him, and she cannot have or be with the man she does love. Tristan, meanwhile, cannot have the woman he loves, and he lies in bed next to a woman he cannot bear to touch. And the Isolde of the White Hands longs for her husband, loves her husband, and he cannot and will not ever touch her. And this description of this quadrille of hurt is, I think, just profound. It gives us a psychological insight to all of the characters, and that's what's important. It's not just that our hero and heroine have feelings, as is the case in, I think, Berul, you could say. But here, there are other people whose feelings matter, and we see that. There's an astonishing moment episode worth mentioning. Isolde of the White Hands is one day riding along with her brother, and her horse steps in a puddle and water splashes up her thigh, and she starts laughing uncontrollably. And her brother, who's a bit paranoid, says, "Tell me why you're laughing." And she says, "That water touched higher up my thigh than my husband has ever touched me." And it's the most astonishing moment. So it's that psychological realism which is incredible in Thomas.
Can I go to you, Mark? Laura laid out this quartet of... Thomas challenges people, who is the most miserable? Can you develop that? It's an extraordinary thing to do. It challenges the reader directly, doesn't it?
It is. I mean, it's a really good example of this tendency I was talking about earlier, that Thomas, and like him, Gottfried as well, has this very marked tendency of suspending the narrative and then resolving it into abstract or general problems which are then thrown open for debate. So what happens in this commentary is that, as Laura says, Thomas lays out this quadrille of misery. He goes through each of the characters one by one and explains why they have a claim to be miserable in love. And that in itself, I think, is a very interesting statement, that he says, you know, I want to tell you what estrange amour there is among these four, what strange love. It's a thing that brings only misery, quite a striking thing to say if you're telling a love story. But then he...
Times four.
Thomas's narrator says that he's lost for words. He says, "Now I don't know what I can say. Which of the four of these has the greater suffering in love? I will hand the judgment," the jugement, he uses that word, I'll hand the judgment over to lovers in the audience, "because I myself have no experience of it. I've never... Porsuku esprove nulai, because esprover is the verb, try it out, experience, been through it. So that's very
interesting. Him being a monk, I presume, that's...
We assume he is a cleric, so he probably doesn't. Yeah, if he's being a good cleric and an unmarried cleric and a celibate cleric,
then he
would have no direct experience of this. So he hands this over to those. He says, "Those of you in the audience who are lovers, you have experience of these things. You decide." But I think that's, on the one hand, what's really fascinating here, I think, is that on the one hand, it seems as though he puts the audience above him in knowledge. You know, you have experience of something that I haven't, so you're better placed to judge and answer this question than I am. But on the other hand, experience is a very double-edged sword in Thomas. Tristan's decision to marry is based precisely on this idea of wanting to try things out, as Laura was mentioning. Tristan, agonising over whether he should marry the second Isolde, says to himself, I wonder what it's like for the first Isolde to be married and perhaps forgetting about her lover. The only way I can know whether she has forgotten me is I'll need to marry the second Isolde to try it out, to esprover for myself. And, of course, that's the disastrous thing.
Now, we haven't mentioned the what might be, you tell me if I'm wrong, Laura, the key factor, which is that as Tristan is bringing Isolde back to Cornwall, over to Cornwall from Ireland, to marry Mark, he is accidentally, we're told accidentally, they together are given the love potion by Isolde's servant.
Yeah.
And they take it, and that's it.
Yes.
Now, why was the love potion introduced? Why didn't they just fall in love with each other like they do in movies?
Well, there are lots of different interpretations of this. And in Beirut, as Mark said, it's very clear that it is just a potion. It's a magic trick. It wears off. And then the plot can go in different directions. In Thomas, you can make a perfectly reasonable reading of the whole poem by saying it's just symbolic. It's a way of saying to us as readers, you may not doubt this love now. This is where it's going. In the same way that Chaucer has Troilus struck by an arrow from Cupid. It's a narrative trick to say, you now know this is what's happening. The question, obviously, it has a bearing on the moral question, the question whether they're free to act or whether they're bound into their love. And here I think what's more interesting is if we take it as symbolic, if we then ask ourselves the question of if our emotions are this strong, you know, if this is a love which means that you would burn yourself and the world to be with this person, does that then justify actions you take for that love, or does it not? And in the Middle Ages, there's a strong Christian line that says that the goal of life is to deny the self's longings in order to reach God. Now, we're much more likely to have an ideal of self-fulfillment, to say, you know, it is to be true to myself, to fulfill who I am, to pursue love, to pursue my highest desires. But in fact, Thomas is, I think, ahead of both of those camps. Thomas says, he lays it out for us. He shows us that their emotions explain everything they do, but also that they can't justify anything that they do. And he shows us that through the pain of others. And in that sense, I think he develops a genuine ethical exploration. Can you justify what they do? Well, it's impossible to say. Others are hurt by it. Should they not have done it? They could not do otherwise.
Are there developments like this in earlier versions, or is this bring something completely new to the table?
No, I think there are, because in the Dermot and Grania story, Dermot has a love spot, and it's only in a love spot, something which makes all women fall in love with him. And this is only actually in the oral tales, which we get from Scotland. And Grania puts, when she realises she's married to this old man, puts everybody under a sleep spell and says to Dermot, she puts him under geish, which is a compulsion. Again, it's almost like a love potion. She says, you have to love me. And Deirdre does much the same. Now, we don't have any evidence of what's happening in Welsh. The only hint we have is a rather obscure poem in the Black Book of Carmarthen, where there's clearly been... they've come across the sea. There's clearly been a sea journey, and the lovers are in some kind of upset. So there does seem to be an earlier notion that this love is somehow structured.
Can I come to you again, Mark? Why do you think that appealed to medieval audiences so much as it seems to have done, when it seems so foreign to most of the experience that we get from other literature at the time.
I think it probably does have to have something to do with these changes in marriage practices that Laura was talking about, the church policing and defining marriage increasingly. I mean, you've got to remember, this is a story about an adultery in a royal marriage, and it's written for an aristocratic audience. It begins to take literary form in Western Europe in the second half of the 12th century. That's at the end of a period of about 100 years in which the marriage practices of the European aristocracy, so the very people for whom these stories are being written, their practices are being transformed by the church's ever-encroaching control of marriage. And I suppose what you can say is that until the church had taken over, marriage consisted of two elements. There's a must. You got married because your parents had exchanged contracts. It wasn't up to the individuals at all. And you got married because you ought to. There's a social expectation on you. It is the way of producing legitimate heirs. It is the way of passing down landed property. And with the church's insistence on consent also defining and constituting a marriage, there's a new element, which is that you get married because you want to. The individuals concerned have actually wished it. And if you think about it, what you've got in the adulterous relationship is this mixture of must and should and want. The lovers must love because they're compelled, they drank a potion. They should because they're so suited to each other, and they actually want to. They make statements about how they want to be together. So I think the appeal is that the story offers this kind of fictional medium through this adulterous relationship, through which an aristocratic public can begin to think through what is it that determines why two people are together for life, because they must, because they should be, because they want to be.
Juliet Wood, the story became less popular, and it became sank in status below the great Arthur legends. Is there any one explanation for that?
I think the very complexity of the story and the fact that it works so well within a medieval courtly love tradition where these things mattered. And I think in a modern tradition, somehow it's less compelling. It then becomes more compelling because you can do all kinds of things with this story, and it kind of has a resurgence. But I think the fact that it disappears quickly is simply a change in society.
Laura, the idea of love and death, or love in death, or death sealing love, or completing love, emerges and is taken up later. Had that happened before?
Basically, love only ends in two ways. Either you die or it goes wrong. And therefore, as soon as narrative of love appears, if an author wants to say that someone's love is perfect, then logically we need to see the characters die. We need to see that they loved one another up to the point of death. And a poet called Marie, who calls herself Marie de France, who was writing in England at about the same time as Thomas, she gives us a series of little short romances, lays, in which she toys with different structures of love and shows the connection of love with suffering, the idea that your willingness to suffer shows how noble your love is, and ultimately the connection of love with death, that when you love perfectly, then you love unto your death. And therefore, I think, implicitly, love brings with it death. And Marie retells the Tristan story in a very abbreviated version in which she brings this to a perfect symbol. Their love was so fine, their amour qui tant fut fine, who was so perfect that it brought them to death on the same day.
Do they love unto death or into death?
Well, in the Thomas legend and in Gottfried, we're told that when they drank the love potion, they drank their death. That they drank love, they drank death. Both are the same.
This is taken up very seriously by Wagner in one of his greatest works, where we have the love death at the end, and the music waiting for it, and then resolves itself in the love death. That was that Wagner, or had that become accepted? Had that marinated over the centuries? What's going on there?
I think that's Wagner, this notion of the Liebestod, the love death, that's the fulfilment and your culmination of love. Death is what actually ensures the perpetuation of your love, because it means you won't ever wake up from the night of love. That's what the lovers sing in that duet in the second act of Wagner.
A very, Very early on, in the early versions, when the two lovers die, particularly in the Deirdre version, they're buried on opposite sides of a river, and plants grow out of their graves and unify, and they're cut down and they grow again, and they're cut down and they're finally left. So there is an implication, certainly. There is this folk motif of lovers united in death by the image of these twisting plants, which, of course, Marie takes up very much in her lay. So it's implied. Certainly Wagner's romanticism takes it to the highest levels, or however one sees Wagner. But I think the implication is there beforehand.
Laura?
You're absolutely right. It's picked up everywhere. Marie makes them symbolic. Tristan and Isolde are the hazel and honeysuckle bound together forever. But I think Thomas does something very different. I think he does something unique. I think he implies, because they don't die together. Tristan dies, and then Isolde comes and finds his body and lies down next to it and dies out of despair. We're told, Tristan mourut pour son amour, et la belle Isolde par tendreux. It's not the same. He dies for his love, she dies for pity. They're separated by death. And I think this is because Thomas is not trying to write a symbolic Liebestod. He's not trying to write something celebratory and glorious. He's trying to write something about real suffering.
The same would go for Gottfried. And I think in the case of Gottfried, I think death is the fulfilment of something, but it's not the fulfilment of love. It's the fulfilment of a tragic destiny. It's very interesting that when Tristan, the hero, is baptised, and we mentioned before that the name comes from Trist, sad, and when the infant is baptised, Gottfried's narrator comes in and he gives his German audience a little French lesson and says, that's what the French name means. And he says the name is apt not just because of the sad past, the sad circumstances in which this little baby was conceived and born, but also it's utterly apt because of the sorrowful life that he's going to have, which will culminate in a very sorrowful death. But more than that, Gottfried also then adds that anyone who has read this story to the end will see how the name fitted the man and the man fitted the name. So death is not just the fulfilment of a tragic destiny, it's the fulfilment of an artistic strategy of composing the story in such a way that it inevitably appears to end in death, as though that could be the only possible ending. So in that sense, death is a culminational fulfilment, but not in the way that Wagner understood it.
Finally, Juliet.
Well, I think this goes back to the question you asked of the moral implications of the folk sources of this. And you get this very, very simple repeated motif of the entwined plants. And by the time this develops, right up to the 19th century, it becomes so elaborate that you get this kind of Liebestod business. And I think that says something about the power of these storytelling patterns. They can go on and they can spread and they can be reinterpreted. They can fall out of fashion and they can come back into fashion.
Thank you very much, Juliet Wood, Laura Ashe and Mark Kinker. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
So what didn't we talk about?
Art, and
disguise. Yes. You talked about trickery.
Yes.
So Tristan is always going places in disguise, and
in one of them, but not in all.
Well, so he cunningly calls himself Tantris, with the result that no one recognises him or guesses who he is,
except his dog.
Right. Yes.
But that's played up to great, I think, for comic effect in Gottfried, where Isolde makes a discovery when she's got the splinter of the sword and it fits the notch in Tristan's sword, and she's identified him. Mm. And then she's explaining to her mother how she's come to this discovery and that Tantris is really Tristan. And there's this very laborious explanation which she says, now take the name Tantris. And the mother says, oh, all right. Now you cut it in half into a tan and a tris. And the mother says, OK, I'm with you. And you put the second before the first. And what do you get? And the mother says, oh, my dear, you are so clever. How did you think of this? And I'm convinced that that has to be... played for comic effect.
There's a Fablio sort of element to all of this, which I think is always comic, that the old husband is always being outsmarted by the young wife and her lover. You get this with the tree business where they see Mark reflected
in the water. And then they stage this conversation where they say, how could he possibly suspect us?
There's the German one where he disguises himself as a monk and she's ill and he goes in and cures her. And Mark kind of thanks him profusely. Yes. And you kind of think, this is Boccaccio, basically. And there's a wonderful modern version of this. It's a comic book version. As a folklorist, you're allowed to read comic books, I hasten to add. And in a graphic novel called Arthur 2000, all of Arthur's men are brought back, except Tristan is brought back as a woman. So he grouses about this throughout the whole thing and then decides, no, actually, he's really very happy about this. So you get a lesbian Tristan and Isolde. And I just think that's wonderful.
I also like the way that... So, I mean, I just think Thomas' work is astonishing. I think it's a masterpiece. And I like the way that he has to deal with all of these ideas that Tristan can go in disguise to court and no one will recognise him. Well, in Thomas's version, they always recognise him. They recognise him instantly. You know, as soon as Isolde actually looks at him... She realises panic ensues, you know. And in this sense, I think Thomas is writing about... He's attempting to write about people, recognisable people, you know, not archetypes. Mm. It's not that Tristan and Isolde love one another because he's the greatest knight and she's the most beautiful woman. It's because they happen to be in love, because they are individual characters. You cannot be substituted. You know, Isolde of the White Hands is a hoped-for substitute for Queen Isolde, and it can't work for a second. Because they're individuals.
I think we're about to be interrupted.